T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. President Joe Biden recently held his first call with China's President Xi Jinping, with President Biden touching on human rights abuses against the Uyghurs, while President Xi insisted that Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and Taiwan are internal matters. Will confrontation or cooperation mark Biden's relationship with China? Joining the Crisis Next Door to talk about the impact of new U.S. leadership in the China equation is Ankit Panda, a Stanton Senior Fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and author of Kim Jong-un and the Bomb. Ankit, good to have you back on the Crisis Next Door.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Ankit, Joe Biden got a lot on his plate after taking over in the Oval Office for Donald Trump, and near the top of his to-do list is dealing with China. How would you describe the state of U.S.-China relations following 4 years of Trump?
So I think one of the few areas, and an important area in which we're seeing continuity between the two administrations on foreign policy, is China. And of course, you know, there are exceptions here. For instance, the Biden administration is very unlikely to continue the Trump administration's trade policy. But certainly, I think, as we saw from not only President Biden's first phone call with Xi Jinping, but Secretary of State Tony Blinken's call with Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi, the Biden team is not shying away from raising the uncomfortable issues that now are central to U.S.-China relations. And fundamentally, they see China as a competitor, which is quite different also from the Obama administration. So I think we will see the Biden administration fundamentally have a much more difficult competitive relationship with China than the last time we saw a Democratic president in office.
And much of the relationship with Trump and China really focused on trade. And we had various trade pacts reached between the Trump and Xi Jinping administrations. This time, it seems like the military is a little higher up in the equation. And President Biden did have the Pentagon work on a review of U.S. strategy toward China. And there is a 15-person China task force that's being used to counter Chinese efforts. How would you look at that? And is that the focus where President Biden needs to go in figuring out the military relationship vis-a-vis China and the United States?
Well, it's an interesting question because the Biden administration came into office, you know, fundamentally messaging that diplomacy will be put front and center in the implementation of American foreign policy. And that's certainly true for China still, I think. It is true that we did see an early announcement from the Department of Defense regarding a new task force. My understanding of that task force ambit is that it's largely going to focus on internal DOD matters insofar as China is concerned. So basically taking stock of where things stand after 4 years of the Trump administration, where procurement, acquisitions, internal staffing priorities need to be. Meanwhile, I think we'll see a much broader effort across the administration, beginning with the National Security Council, where we have a new and particularly empowered Indo-Pacific coordinator to deal with not only China policy, but a general U.S. strategy for the Asian region, tackled with a lot of the broader economic, political, diplomatic, and strategic questions that come in preparing for at least 4 years of a competitive relationship with China. But certainly, I think the efforts that are underway at DOD will be an important part of that component. But I think it does bear stating that the Biden administration fundamentally seems more inclined to place diplomacy at the center of its efforts. And that means reassuring allies in the region. It means assuring non-aligned countries that they don't necessarily need to choose between the United States and China, but that fundamentally, if they do decide to maintain a positive relationship with the United States, that their interests will be better served.
There has been a lot of concern about Chinese development of various weapons, hypersonic missiles, space weapons, advances in artificial intelligence. Are these legitimate concerns that China is gaining that technological advantage over the U.S. military?
Well, I wouldn't know. I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that the Chinese are about to seize the technological lead, so to speak, from the United States. Both countries are competing across many categories of weapon systems. There are some areas where China appears to be pulling ahead. For instance, Chinese advancements in things like quantum computing, quantum communications tend to be a little bit further ahead than at least the militarized applications here in the United States. But on other technologies, China can do certain things, and there's no particular reason that the United States needs to mirror image Chinese capabilities to compete. In fact, the way in which the United States should go about building a strategy for China is first identifying the kinds of scenarios that we'd like to deter. So in the United States, a lot of the conversation right now focuses on Taiwan Strait contingencies. Chinese pressure on Taiwan has been increasing under Xi Jinping. President Xi has made no secret of his intention to unify with Taiwan by force if he feels that Taiwan is moving towards independence. So this is a particular situation that has seized a lot of attention insofar as planning is concerned. But in terms of specific technical prescriptions, I tend to think the United States can still compete. And under the Biden administration, I think we are seeing an effort to continue what under the Obama administration was identified as this so-called third offset strategy for the United States, because it might not be able to compete numerically with Russia or China, especially China, which in the Indo-Pacific will maintain a numerical advantage over, let's say, the U.S. Navy with simply more ships and assets. So the way the United States identified to compete there is to simply lead on technology and make sure that we are at the cutting edge. And those efforts, I think, very much remain on track.
The Taiwan question has been around for decades. Do you feel that China is even remotely considering a cross-strait invasion of Taiwan? Obviously, it would invite a U.S. response. Is it really a fear that China would actually do something so drastic?
Well, look, in the 1990s, the Chinese fired missiles into the Taiwan Strait over concerns that then president of Taiwan was unacceptably sort of deferential to the ambiguities that exist across the Taiwan Strait regarding the status of the two countries. Under Biden, I think, these concerns are, again, real. They've sort of been at the forefront. And the Chinese military, again, makes no secret of this. It's in every strategic document or white paper that they release. They talk about Taiwan contingencies. They're very open about the fact that this is one of their top envisaged warfighting scenarios. That said, is China going to invade Taiwan tomorrow? Probably not. The conditions on the Taiwan Strait right now, even as pressure on Taiwan is increasing, there are simply too many costs associated here for China. It's not something that would be risk-free for China to undertake this sort of an attack on Taiwan. But this does require active efforts at deterrence across the Taiwan Strait. If we don't want China to carry out such an invasion, we have to focus on the capabilities, the relationships, the assurance, not only for Taiwan, but other allies in the Indo-Pacific region, to ensure that we continue to create the conditions where China will calculate that it's the benefits of not carrying out such an invasion outweigh the costs. So that's where we are today. I'm not especially anticipating any kind of Chinese action in the near term. But certainly, I think under the Biden team, there will be a sustained effort at continuing some of the Trump administration's more positive moves towards Taiwan, ensuring in particular that the U.S. Relationship with Taiwan does not become a function of the U.S. relationship with China, and it can be something that exists for its own benefit and on its own merits.
Another potential area of conflict has been the South China Sea, where China has made great expansion over recent years. There have been a number of Asian countries in that sphere that were U.S. allies for a long time, then started to pull away from the U.S. Now it seems like they're coming back a little bit. There was a survey conducted by Singapore's ISEAS Yusof Ishak Institute that found that there were more of those countries that were moving towards the United States rather than China. It said that China's predominant economic and political influence in the region has created more awe than affection. Could Biden win over more of those Asian nations that have had to deal with China's expansion in the South China Sea? And how would that help the U.S. in its relations with China?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes the Trump administration made was not paying due attention to Southeast Asia, which is a critical, not only geographic linchpin in the Indo-Pacific region, sort of sitting between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, but the 10 countries that comprise the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, for instance, have always looked for the United States to be a visible presence in the region. And the administration simply didn't follow through in the way that the Obama administration did, for instance, by attending the East Asia Summit and Summitry with ASEAN leaders. For President Trump, this really wasn't a priority. He was much more interested in dealing at the great power level, be that with Russia or China, or European partners, for instance. But for the Biden team, I think, they very much recognize that Southeast Asia will need to be a big part of any future US approach to competition with China. So this will be an important component. US treaty allies, for instance, Thailand and the Philippines, have received a lot of attention. Partners like Singapore, with the United States, has important facilities for naval operations are also going to receive due attention. Of course, there has been a lot of discussion in recent weeks over Myanmar, given the coup there. So that too, I think, will ensure that the Biden team is thinking more carefully about geopolitical competition. Now, you mentioned the South China Sea. The fundamental U.S. interest in the South China Sea has really been unchanged since the Obama administration, which is the freedom of the seas, freedom of navigation, freedom of overflight. We want our naval vessels and commercial tankers and shipping vessels to basically have free maneuver through these international waters. It is true that China has built artificial islands and militarized them. But ultimately, I think the Biden team recognizes, just like the Trump team did, that you can't really roll that back. It's what's called sort of a fait accompli in international affairs that the Chinese have asserted and created new facts on the ground in the South China Sea. But the administration will have to ensure that relations between China and certain Southeast Asian states, here I'm particularly thinking of Vietnam, don't spiral out of control in the near future and lead to a potential conflict in that part of the world.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and I'm talking about President Biden's China strategy with Ankit Panda, a Stanton Senior Fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's estimated that there are 3 million Uyghurs in concentration camps in China, and this was a big focus of President Biden's call with Xi Jinping. What can Biden or the U.S. or the world do about the Uyghurs? Is it possible for a resettlement of the Uyghurs somewhere else so they could live their lives without the attention that they're getting from Beijing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, so the first step here is accurately diagnosing the problem and calling it out. And the Trump administration certainly did that. We have no shortage of statements from the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, for instance, calling out China's practices. But there was a sense that, human rights, and in particular, the situation in Xinjiang, where China is carrying out cultural genocide, was being used as a cudgel of sorts against the Chinese Communist Party and President Xi Jinping. Now, the Biden team, I think, is aware of not coming off in this way, but certainly I think they've also made a very public statement that, they will be placing values again at the center of American foreign policy. That will mean fundamentally recognizing that any sort of cooperative relationship with China will be a cooperative relationship that ultimately will be with the regime that is carrying out these things in Xinjiang. Now, you asked a little bit about what can be done in practice. There, I think things are a lot more difficult. I mean, there is, of course, wisdom and benefit to be had in building international coalitions around this issue, ensuring, for instance, that American businesses don't source materials created with forced labor in Xinjiang. And many of these efforts are already underway. The previous administration already began leveraging targeted sanctions against senior Chinese Communist Party officials that were directly implicated in setting up the prison camp system that we currently see in Xinjiang. Short of that, though, can the Biden administration compel or force China's hand on its internal practices in Xinjiang? Unfortunately, I don't think the answer to that is yes. And I think what that means ultimately is the administration will have to decide if and when it does decide to cooperate with China, let's say on things like climate change, to what extent will it allow these broader issues, Xinjiang, Taiwan, the fate of Tibet, of Hong Kong, where there's a separate crackdown, how far will allow these issues to override the broader agenda? And I think the United States will begin to see, we're already seeing civil society across the country wake up to the nature of the Chinese Communist Party regime, not just over what's happening in Xinjiang, but also over the Communist Party's attempts to export authoritarianism overseas. I think we saw a big wake-up call a couple of years ago when China attempted to crackdown on the general manager of the Houston Rockets, I think people began to realize that the influence of the Chinese Communist Party is in many ways permeating and influencing many aspects of life that Americans had thought to be sort of sealed off from this sort of influence. So I think all of these factors will fundamentally orient the Biden administration towards a much more confrontational approach where China is concerned.
That's very interesting. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation recently met, and they did not say anything in regards to the Uyghurs and China's policies with the Uyghurs. You've got Pakistan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia as members of that. Is this a result of China's Belt and Road Initiative, where simply it's able to buy off those governments and avoid any criticism of its handling of its Uyghur population?
Well, I think that's part of the story. I mean, in general, a lot of these countries will only comment on the internal affairs of other states when it's politically suitable or diplomatically suitable. And in the case of China, it's simply not. They have too much to gain from maintaining a positive diplomatic rapport. It's not just economics. It's not just trade. A lot of these countries see China as an important strategic partner at the global level. Many of them buy arms from China. So these factors, again, I think, weigh on these decisions. Broadly speaking, though, the Belt and Road Initiative has been an important part of China's bid to spread its influence in the Asian region and more broadly globally. So this is, again, an important factor. The trade issue is bigger than the OIC, right? I mean, the Europeans, last year, China was Europe's biggest trading partner, and that's weighing on how a lot of European capitals are thinking about the extent to which they're willing to go out of their way to take a stand with the United States, for instance, on issues not only limited to Xinjiang, but other issues on the U.S.-China agenda. So all of these factors, I think, combine to make for a particularly difficult decision for many governments when it comes to calling out and criticizing China on these issues.
Ankit, you mentioned Hong Kong, and we've seen Beijing's crackdown in the pro-democracy movement over the past couple of years. And now Beijing is overhauling Hong Kong's education system with the patriotic education, and a lot of people call it brainwashing. Is that what this is?
Well, look, I mean, I think Hong Kong's special status after 1997, that was meant to be respected for a period of 50 years, that ship has sailed. Hong Kong today is effectively as good as just any other city in China. And of course, at the time of the handover, Hong Kong represented a significantly larger proportion of China's GDP than it does today. So I think the Communist Party has recognized that even if what they're doing in Hong Kong spooks investors, expatriates, causes an outflux of multinational companies, for instance, that no longer see the legal and regulatory environment that they had come to expect obtain in Hong Kong, the benefits will ultimately be worth it because, as the Communist Party says, its core interests when it comes to things like territorial integrity are paramount. So everything that's been going on in Hong Kong since 2019, since the passage of the national security legislation, is ultimately, I think, being done with that goal in mind. So yes, I would say the education reform that we're unfortunately seeing in the city is just another nail in the coffin here.
And there have been a lot of calls over the past couple of years of Hong Kong and pro-democracy supporters for the U.S. to get more involved against China in this. But again, are President Biden's hands tied in this case? Is there much that he can do to help out the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong?
Well, again, I mean, he's not going to be able to compel the Chinese Communist Party's behavior in Hong Kong. There are steps that the United States can still take, for instance, allowing for pro-democracy activists to seek asylum in the United States. The Biden administration has already expanded the number of planned refugee acceptances in the United States tenfold from the Trump era limits. And some of that will hopefully go not only to folks fleeing Hong Kong that have reason to fear for persecution at the hands of the Communist Party, but from other parts of China as well. So that's going to be a big part of this. But ultimately, I think, the biggest lesson I think the Biden team is taking away from Hong Kong, and a lot of Americans are, is what it suggests for the future of Taiwan, for instance, which very much, I think, now, given the experience in Hong Kong, will be much more likely to reject any notion of peaceful unification with China, voluntarily unifying with China under any kind of compromise deal where, let's say, Taiwan would be allowed to maintain its autonomy. Given what the Communist Party's done in Hong Kong, I simply think those kinds of assurances just won't be credible if they ever were in the past.
One final area I wanted to touch on with you, Ankit, is regarding the media and freedom of speech and reporting when it comes to Chinese matters. China recently banned the BBC after its reporting of the Uyghur situation, and there have been U.S. and other foreign correspondents unable to get visas renewed in China, and there's been ongoing harassment of foreign correspondents in China. How important is that to get foreign correspondents back into China and developing a communication between China and the U.S. and other countries where there could be more understanding between those countries?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say here is I think China has in many ways underestimated the international press in the last few years. I mean, back in 2017, it wasn't the U.S. government. It wasn't Mike Pompeo, who I guess wasn't Secretary of State until 2018, but his predecessor, Rex Tillerson, that was talking about concentration camps in Xinjiang. It was the media, right? We had great reports from AFP, BuzzFeed, several other organizations that had conducted on-the-ground reporting, testifying to what was happening. And unfortunately, it was in the early phases back then in Xinjiang. And I think, it's sort of a straight line from there to the recent decision to ban the BBC. Of course, China has never been a particularly favorable environment for international reporting. But I think the extent to which, the Communist Party is now willing to crack down on organizations like the BBC, seen as among the most impartial in the entire world, is, I think, a worrying omen of the general direction of repression under Xi Jinping. I think, there is, of course, an urgency here to get reporters back. We need to have a sense of what is actually happening, not just, in the financial and trade presses that cover business developments in Shanghai, Shenzhen, and Beijing, for instance, but we need to know what's happening in Tibet, in Xinjiang. But the Communist Party, precisely because it is under so much scrutiny over these issues internationally, now sees a strategic impulse to basically deny the outside world as much information as it can, and from all sources that it can. So I think, unfortunately, what happened to the BBC is likely to soon spread to the other few news organizations that do manage to maintain foreign staff inside China today.
Ankit, one final question. How do you see U.S. relations with China over the next 4 years with President Biden? Do you see a possible improvement, or do you think pretty much status quo?
I actually do think things will get worse before they get better. I mean, the status quo is not stable. We are heading in a direction of, I think, increased friction between the two countries. I think the Biden team will be smart enough to recognize that precisely because we are heading in the direction of more friction, that there will be an impulse to continue to interact and engage with China. And that means we'll need to keep military-to-military dialogues happening so we don't have misunderstandings at sea or in the air in Asia where a miscalculation could lead to conflict, for instance. But broadly speaking, I'm not very optimistic given the current trajectory.
A very sobering analysis, Ankit. President Biden obviously has his hands full. Thank you for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Ankit Panda, a Stanton Senior Fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly. If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.